I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the In the Loop Story Slam. Our theme tonight, Achilles' Heel. And Dave Good is on stage with me. Dave, thanks for coming out.
Hey, no problem.
Says here, and of course, we get little tidbits of information about everybody who steps on stage. Tells me you're a wanderer, Dave Good, but you've turned 31, and you've decided to get serious with life now.
That's kind of a bit of an overstatement, but yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I was kind of one of those extremely overscheduled, like, professional kids, you know? And so I decided to have a childhood from 25 to 31, and it was a good time, but yeah, now I'm back in the Midwest where I originally grew up, and you know.
Yeah, this is the place to be.
Well, you know.
When you're done having fun, come back to the Midwest.
I just wanted to live somewhere where I appeared short and tan.
All right, welcome to the Story Slam. Dave Good.
This is about a time I learned about another guy's Achilles heel, just by only really meeting him one time. And I've got a title for this story. It's called The German Shepherd's Crunchy Groove. Okay, so I'm going to school in St. Louis, and I'm working for the Sierra Club, and I'm not really fitting in too much because, like, I'm a hippie and everything. Like, I got long hair, but I don't really like jam bands. You know, I'm not really into the Grateful Dead, and so I don't, like, fit in. But I do want to fit in. I try to fit in. So this friend of mine, Dan, asked me if I want to go to the Gypsy by the River Music Festival in Lesterville, Missouri. So I decided to go. Well, I get there, you know, and we're setting up the tent, and we're, like, observing the hippie commune as it, like, gets put together. And we realize we're in, like, next to a very key part of this economy. We are setting up our tent right next to the commune's pot dealer. And so this guy, he's got, like, a truck, and in the back of the truck there's a cooler, and on top of the cooler is this big German shepherd with, like, a kind of long chain, and it's, like, guarding the pot, you know? And so I'm hanging out with Dan, and he's telling me about the benefits of being a vegetarian, and I'm kind of buying into this, so I decide I'm going to cook my burger and feed it to this dog, you know, because it's never a bad idea to be friends with the pot dealer. And anyways, we're sitting there, and there's this hippie, and he's, like, wandering happily through the communes, you know, this old hippie, and he's clearly, you know, in a good mood, like, he's hallucinating heavily, and he walks right by the weed dealer's truck, and this dog just attacks. It's crazy. It's like this horrific, violent scene, and he's got a cast on his arm, like, covered in, like, hippie paraphernalia, and if it wasn't for the cast, like, he might have been hurt, but he, like, gives the cast to the dog, and, I mean, it's this crazy, snarling, just insane moment. And Dan and I, you know, we feel kind of bad. It's kind of like this evil dog of capitalism, like, you know, busted through our, like, hippie wonderful moment. And I was... You know, I have to say, I was pretty scarred. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be hallucinating and get attacked by a German Shepherd. So the hippie festival was fun, and, you know, I had a good time. And so, of course, I continue to go to the jam bands. I mean, my social life, I found out, depended on this. And I'm at a show, and it's like set break at the show. So we go out, and we are hanging out in the parking lot, you know, all smoking in a circle, cigarettes. Who walks up into the circle but this old hippie? It's the guy who got attacked by the dog, and I'm just like, oh my God, I'm standing next to this guy, and I'm like, excuse me, sir, by any chance, were you at a hippie music festival, and did you get, like, horribly attacked by a German Shepherd? And he's like, no, man, that wasn't me. And I'm just like, really, that wasn't you? He's like, no, I didn't get attacked by a dog. So I'm sitting there and, like, thinking, like, how could I have confused this guy? And, like, the silence is building, and I'm just standing there, and he goes, oh, wait, dude, I did get attacked by a dog. So I have a feeling I know what this guy's Achilles heel is, and it's LSD.
Dave Good, thank you, Dave. This is the Story Slam from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and with me on stage now is George A. Keller. George, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're an actress, so you should feel fairly comfortable in front of our crowd here.
I do. Thanks for making me feel that way, peeps. You rock.
You call them peeps. They just have to warm up.
You know, are you okay with peeps? It's after Easter. Okay.
Well, we're glad you're here. It says you've got a new event coming up on my card here, and that's fairly general, so why don't you fill me in?
It is called My Variety Show, and it is going to be Sundays in June at the Bryant Lake Bowl. It'll be the first four Sundays at Bryant Lake Bowl, and it's sure to amuse and, you know, tantalize you. I did that while I was wiggling my fingers next to my bosom. Okay, tantalize. Okay.
Yeah, it's working. Okay.
Okay.
Now, when you stepped on stage, I looked at the card very quickly, and I was tempted to call you Georgia. I'm curious about the name, George.
My name. I was named after my grandfather. His name was George Washington Morse, and he was a preacher, and I was the last child, and my mother knew she wasn't going to crank out another one, and there was already a boy named after my dad's dad. Do you get that? I'm tangential. I'm sorry.
So you became a girl named George.
I did.
Easy to remember you. All right.
So
I'll give us a little something to remember you about here on the Story Slam.
I will do that. Thank you.
You bet.
There are few things on this planet more enjoyable than a bowl or five of Kemp's old-fashioned vanilla ice cream. I have crumbled on many occasions to the soft caresses of this smooth, velvety concoction. And anyone who knows me knows that I still cannot be trusted around this treat. As a matter of fact, my first try at shoplifting was brought on by the need for ice cream. I was 7 years old and was with Karen, who was my age, and her two older sisters, Margaret and Kathy. It was a hot day, and we were bored. The day started with us on the way to the store to pick up cigarettes. It was for the neighbor down the street. She wrote us a note. You could do that back in the olden days, people. It said, "To whom it may concern, please allow these girls to buy me cigarettes. Sincerely, Susan." We pranced down Nicollet Avenue singing our favorite Monkees songs. For me, it was a toss-up between "A Little Bit You, A Little Bit Me," sung by Davy Jones, and "I'm a Believer," sung by Mickey Dolenz. That's right, baby. We skipped and ran and corrected each other, not only on the proper lyrics of the songs, but also on who was the cutest monkey. I always thought Davy was the cutest monkey, but I was not allowed to have him as my monkey because Kathy had claimed him first. I had Peter Tork, and he was not a pretty monkey. He was the one that was left over after they chose monkeys when I was not there. Okay, I digress. Anyway, when we got to the store, I told the girls I had some money and I wanted to get something while we were there and that I'd meet them in the front. In truth, I had to pee. At the end of my bathroom escapade, I washed my hands. Okay, I didn't really wash my hands. I want to say that because that's what you're supposed to do, but let's face it, I was 7 on a quest to get cigarettes with a note, and it was the 70s. All right. When exiting the back room of the store, I found myself in the frozen food aisle, and I wandered slowly singing "Pleasant Valley Sunday" from my Monkees album, when out of the blue, I spotted it. Kemp's vanilla ice cream. Oh, it was so simple, you know? Oh my God, a whole tub of delicious white soft stuff in my mouth began to water. I pressed my nose against the glass, looking for the price of my torturesome desire, and I concluded that the 85 cents in my pocket wasn't nowhere near what I needed to gain ownership of my immediate pleasure. So my heart began to race, and my palms were sweaty, and I was possessed. I imagined myself at home in my room with nothing but a spoon dangling from my very own tub of ice cream while watching the monkeys on TV giggling with the high of sugar and piracy. Oh, yes, I had decided to do the unthinkable. Now, the container was not so small, and I knew that I hadn't time to figure out how to conceal this giant yummy and make my getaway. So I shakily opened the door of the freezer case, and I grabbed the half-gallon container of ice cream and shoved it up my shirt. was cold. Now, I realized that this was now a matter of speed and stealth. I ran up the aisle and saw my girlfriend showing the note for the cool cigarettes to the cashier. And as he joked with them about how they were a little too young to be taking up this habit, I tried to cruise past when the temperature became too much for my little baby belly, and I dropped it out of my shirt, and it skidded to a halt in front of the door where I was hoping to exit with my treasure. Everything seemed to go in slow motion after that. The girls beginning to laugh from shock. The cashier tilting his head to the side like a German shepherd hearing a high-pitched squeal. And the hand of another grocer on my shoulder. Now, I know what you're thinking, but wait. What happened next was the strangest gift I could have received at that moment. You see, the ice cream had hit the big toe of my bare foot and was gushing blood on the waxed linoleum floor. And somehow, no one except me seemed to remember where the ice cream had come from. Mm-hmm. All I know is minutes later, I had a lollipop in my mouth and was being bandaged by the shopkeeper while my friends held my hand. I was lucky, to be sure. And when I got home and replayed my newly invented tale of my toe to my mother, she sat me down to watch the monkeys on TV and made me my very own bowl of Kemp's vanilla ice cream. Thanks, I'm George Keller.
Thank you, George. Valiantly attempted by our house band, The Smarts. It's not easy to do a... Let's see, you try to do a monkey's medley on the fly. Now, up on the stage of the story slam, a good friend of In the Loop, Robert, don't call me Bobby, Fisher. And we first ran into Robert because we were looking for people who were frustrated with being confused on the internet for other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bobby Fischer.
Yeah.
Bobby Fischer died recently.
Yeah, he did.
He's died since we talked to you about that.
Yeah.
Does that change things for you at all?
It was really oddly personal, and that was kind of bizarre because, you know, whatever. But
kind of like when something happens to your twin and you feel it.
Yeah, I guess. But I am proud to say that I now beat him out in all but one Google hit, so there you go.
Nice work. As Robert or as Bobby?
As Robert. I'm not Bobby.
Right, the Robert technique.
Yeah.
Robert Fisher, glad to have you on the Story Slam.
Yeah, glad to be here. Oscar Wilde, the patron saint of the pithy quote, has a saying that I've somewhat taken to heart. A vice, once public, is virtue. And it's in that spirit that I come before you to admit not only my own weakness, but the weakness of my whole family. The giggles. My family seems to have a knack of walking into the most serious of times, which require privacy and solemnity and earnestness and even pain, and turning them into the kind of stories that you tell your friends on a Friday night. Let's take my Grandpa Bob. Now, my Grandpa Bob was an Air Force pilot in World War II. He flew P-51 Mustangs in the Pacific Theater. Nice. Although he never really crashed, per se, he had this unfortunate tendency to land really hard. The kind of really hard that blows every rivet in the plane and gets you ripped a new one by the sergeant who has to fix it. He swore up and down that it was always the plane's fault. The plane itself always failed on him, and that's why he had all these problems. But for a plane that treated him so badly, he spent a lot of time loving it. He had pictures of it and models of it and even a P-51 Mustang phone that was probably 9 inches long and 6 inches wide, which makes it pretty much worthless as an actual telephone. After he died, I took his favorite P-51 Mustang picture with me. I decided to put it up in my office, so I went to move the picture from its ratty old frame to a nicer one. When I opened it up, I discovered two surprises. One, the picture, which he had adored for so many years, was clipped badly from a newspaper. Two, the picture itself was covering up another picture in the same frame. a childhood portrait of my aunt, his daughter. I can only assume that there was some point years ago where he held this adorable picture of his little baby girl in one hand and this magazine clipping of some random person in a plane in the other and went, you know what? I see her every day. And so up on the wall the clipping went with my aunt still hiding behind it. My grandpa Bob was like that. The way that we related to him was through sports. My grandpa Bob had this deep love of sitting out on his back porch and watching his teams. His teams were the Cubs, the Bears, and the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. And that one guy over there apparently likes him too. And when he'd sit out there, he'd always have this beer in his hand. I'm not even sure he drank it, to be honest, but it was always there, and it kind of became his trademark. So after my grandfather passed away, my brother and my father and I went down to his funeral. The night before the funeral, we sat out on the back with this can of my grandpa's stuff and watching the Cubs play. The Cubs actually won that night, which is a miracle I attribute directly to my grandfather's spiritual intervention. But as we sat out back, we had some trouble trying to figure out a good way to give my grandpa Bob a proper send-off. See, my grandpa Bob really loved life, and he had a whole lot of fun, and it seemed wrong to acknowledge the end of his mortal life by putting him in a suit and saying some tearful things. Those times out in the back porch were how we wanted to remember Grandpa Bob, so we were going to make sure that Grandpa Bob was buried with his beer. We figured we were going to get our collective butts kicked by my aunt or my mom if they found out about the plan, so we worked out the details. At the funeral, we'd hide the beer in our jackets. We'd go through the viewing line after my mom and my aunt, and we'd slip it into the corner of the coffin among all the frills and stuffing and stuff. Then we'd know that he went down with it. And just in case the Cubs played in heaven, you know. I doubt they'll be brewing that stuff up there. Anyway, the next day the funeral came. The plan went off without a hitch. We got the beer into the coffin, and we were feeling pretty sneaky and proud of ourselves, which, by the way, is not how you should be feeling at your grandfather's funeral. But things had gone off without a hitch until we realized that we hadn't planned for something. My grandmother. She came in after us. Despite obviously being an emotional wreck, my grandmother was perfectly coiffed and made up. This whole week, she had coped by being very, very particular with everything. Things had to be just so and just right. And judging from my brother's face when she entered, he must have been having the same thought. A beer in the coffin was not going to qualify as either just so or just right. And truth be told, I felt kind of crappy about it. With my grandma going through so much, how could we have been so disrespectful to play our little game? Suddenly, our cunning plan just seemed kind of childish. What was I supposed to do? Run up there and rip the beer out of the coffin in front of the gathered crowd? It was too late. So I watched my grandmother enter and walk up the aisle and come to the side of her husband, who she loves so much. She tearfully looked over his body, obviously filled with the kind of pain that I can only imagine. And then her eyes came to rest on the beer. Our goose was cooked, and it was all over. When she saw the beer, though, she looked a little confused. She reached up for it and pulled it out of the coffin. And, oh God, here it comes. She held the beer for a minute as if she couldn't even believe it was there. And then she put the beer right in his folded hands, resting on the middle of his chest. Apparently, that's how she wanted to remember him, too.
Robert Fisher.